The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Scott Byrne Fraser, Director of Product Design at Dazen. Yeah, mate. Well, like I was saying, it's interesting when I always think about this different state of minds that people get in throughout the week. It's, you know, I think you, when you kind of progress through your career and you have people that I suppose are more reliant on you and you have to manage people, I don't know whether you get it, but I certainly feel a bit more of a sense of pressure as I've become more senior to be kind of more on, you know, and kind of force yourself into, you know, being in a better mood, and you know, I guess you feel a sense of responsibility around that. Maybe that's just me, but I think there's some probably truth in that.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I think as I've moved through my career, I've become more and more aware that people do react to how they perceive that you're behaving, and you know, they look to you and they look at how you're behaving. And if you have that bad morning where you're a bit tired and you haven't quite had that coffee, and they come to speak to you about something and you're not on full form, you can see how it affects people. So it's definitely something I've become aware of. And something I speak to a lot of, you know, my peers about. You know, people ask a lot of questions, and it's often about, you know, how should I be behaving in this situation in order to get the best out of other people? And I find that entire subject quite fascinating. You know, what's one person's behavior? What's their impact having on somebody else? And actually, are either party actually aware that that's taking place? Because I think often they're not. You know, I think people in the team aren't necessarily aware that they're so led by other people in the team.
You have to kind of dig out those sort of kind of social enigmas as well. It's incredible the impact that one person can have. You can also have those people as well that have like that huge positive impact on the team culturally. And I think because it's difficult to quantify that, right? It's hard to kind of elevate those people and place a value on someone like that in a team who, you know, is incredibly positive and, you know, funny or whatever the thing is that keep the kind of morale and the culture ticking over. But those kind of people are really so significant to the team.
Yeah, you're totally right. And it's interesting that you can't really put a value on that. It's not like you hire for that. You know, when you look at any kind of job role, you never have a criteria being you need to be the life and soul of the party, or you need to be the person that's telling jokes every other day. You know, that's not something anyone ever hires for. But it's those type of people in the team that can add something really positive to it. And even if they're not necessarily the best people at the team of what you hire them for, they can actually lift up everybody else in the group. So they're the kind of people you do want around. But yeah, I totally take your point. It's a very tricky one to actually make sure you get into the team and you get that balance right. And you often don't realise it until they move on to another team, and then you realise that there's a hole that's been left behind, and it's not something you can kind of pass over to somebody else. You can't say to somebody, can you please write a handover note about the jokes that you're going to be telling next week and the great nights out you're going to be sending out. It's not the kind of thing you can directly hand over.
Yeah, it's true. But it's hard to interview for that, though, I suppose, isn't it? That's the difficult bit, because everyone's kind of, you know, everyone's putting on some sort of a front, I suppose, in an interviewing process. I suppose trying to probably be as neutral as possible is the classic, I suppose. So it's quite hard, like say, to identify those people that are going to be positive. I mean, I think it's easy. You can identify personality traits, but then when you're kind of building into the team, you know, you have to kind of go a particular direction. For me personally, like I like to have people on team that are like totally different. And I don't think everyone bought into that totally. But for me, I like everyone on my team is completely different than the next person. And I've kind of always tried to kind of live by that. And I think that it creates a culture that I feel, and obviously it's relatively kind of, you know, subjective, but I feel is the optimal environment that I want to be in as well, because another one of me would clearly be unbearable. So there's no point in trying to hire for that.
Yeah, I certainly don't need any more of me on the team. No, I agree. I think,
you know, when you are building teams, you are trying to think about, you know, the different types of personalities you want in there. And if you end up, particularly within design, you know, when you're designing or you're building products, if you have a group of people that are all essentially identical, then it's very hard to break out the box and think creatively. You know, they'll do a fantastic job of solving one problem. They'll do it very well. They may solve it once or twice. But then over time, they're gonna run out of ideas because they don't have anybody to bounce off that isn't just an exact echo chamber of themselves. And I think if you don't have that mixture of different personalities, that mixture of different levels, that mixture of backgrounds, that mixture of cultures, you soon run into issues. And I've seen it happen time and time again, where there have been a team of people that, you know, end up getting to know each other very well, but end up essentially being able to think identical to each other. And that means that they're all going to come up with exactly the same solution to the same problem. So you don't necessarily get that that same creative spark. I guess then the challenge for, you know, leading a team is to make sure you keep people fresh and you keep making sure they're doing the right types of activities that inspire them to come up with new ideas, that are getting them to think, you know, away from the obvious solutions.
I think our experiences and everyone's experiences, I suppose, mold us into our thoughts on how you kind of is best to optimize a team's performance. You know, you clearly worked at some huge companies, and I'm sure there's probably very different ethos at those organizations as well. Do you think that, you know, you've kind of taken bits and, you know, can you kind of expand on that, what you've taken from those organizations that kind of molded you into having the kind of vision that you probably have now for how you like to see a team execute and culturally and performance in general?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, throughout my career, I've worked in, you know, some big organizations. You know, the BBC is huge, Amazon's huge. I think the key thing about those organizations is that there are lots of different multiple little cultures. You know, every team has got a very different culture and every team works in a very different way. Although there is an overarching culture of how they approach things, they do act very, very differently. I think coming from a design perspective, design is essentially solving problems. You're trying to be creative all the time. And big organizations try to put process in place and try to put, essentially try to silo things. It's never deliberately, but they do try to do that. And I think creativity and silo process do not sit hand in hand. You know, they force people into trying to just solve something the same way as they did beforehand, which isn't necessarily right for designers. So I think some of the key things I've taken away from all those big organizations is you kind of have to, when you're leading them teams, you kind of have to act like a shield. So you can create this atmosphere of, for want of a better word, controlled chaos, where you can have the right atmosphere within the group of people you're working with to be able to give them projects, to be able to work with them, for them to have the freedom to be able to come up with crazy ideas, to be able to fail really quickly, to be able to come up with a solution that actually works, but then keep them shielded from the rest of the process in the organization. Because the second that process hits them, it tells them they need to act and work in a certain way. And every big organization I've worked in, I think, has had that challenge. The BBC, I worked in a number of teams which were quite autonomous. At BBC News, it was a team that was essentially, the remit was essentially just to come up with really cool ideas to help tell news stories. The team was called the BBC News Specials Team. And the entire focus of that team was to try and tell compelling stories using interaction design and data-led journalism. But to do it away from the main website as such, but basically a playground to come up with cool ideas. And you couldn't do that if you were trying to follow the process that were, you know, the typical development processes that were in place for a larger website, you know, for the larger experiences and all the other products. You had to kind of create a sense of, we were kind of apart from that. And we were, you know, we were working independently of that. I think one of the challenges that team had, and then the same when I was at BBC Sport, because that was similar, I think the challenges they had is as they got bigger and as they got more successful, and then the rest of the organization started to plug into it and they started to mix with it, you started to see that freedom diluted. So those processes were put in place. You know, there were, for very sensible reasons, you know, you want to make sure that everybody in the business is aware, you want to make sure all the stakeholders are kind of aligned, all the kind of key things that everybody knows you should do in a big organization. But all those things ultimately lead to that team having less autonomy, and the less autonomy and freedom they have, then the less daring and risky a project tends to be. So you end up with something relatively safe than that you had before.
Is it, do you kind of fight against that stereotype that it's impossible to kind of create autonomy within a kind of big organization? Is that something that, you know, everyone's clearly heard before, But is it something that you kind of, you know, it's not necessarily true and there are ways to do it. It's just down to, you know, like say the responsibilities of the senior leadership team to create an environment that allows, you know, autonomy, you know, the different methodologies, for example.
Yeah, I think it's hard. And I think it's definitely difficult. And there is some validity in saying, not that it's impossible, but certainly that it is difficult to achieve. Where I've seen it work is when individual teams, normally relatively small teams, are able to act off the radar. So able to put in place projects, which can be alongside another project, or they've managed to get a piece of funding that lets them create a proof of concept, or they've managed to work potentially with a third party that gives them a bit of outside external space. But however they've done it, they've managed to create they create that shield. They brought themselves off the radar. So the rest of the business is going on and delivering what it needs to do. And maybe them as a team are still inputting into the business exactly what the business wants them to do. But then that team themselves have been able to then have that freedom away from the rest of the business. I think then the challenge there is, though, that only happens for a short period of time. I think those kind of teams can get away with that up until the point that project starts to become reasonably successful again and then start to get sucked back into the main body. And for quite a while, I was quite frustrated about that kind of thing, because you start to see a team of people doing some awesome stuff and then, you know, get essentially dragged down by the bureaucracy of a bigger organization. But I think I came to the realization that actually that was fine. You know, it's a bit like fireworks going off in an organization. You can set one off and it will explode and it will be amazing and you'll get something really interesting out of it. Then it fizzles away again. Then you set another one off. And it's actually fine to operate in that kind of way, because you can kill people in teams with potentially the same people, potentially different people, but you can make it happen. But of course, the challenge there is it can appear slow to the rest of the world, because, you know, for those projects to go beyond proof of concepts and for them to go beyond ideas, they do at some point have to interface with the rest of the organization.
I want to kind of shift it a little bit now to the kind of the role in itself, the creative director role, the UX stuff, obviously now head of product. Interesting thing for me about product is that it is still relatively a relatively new role from my understanding, right? The product manager, the product director. You know, I'm sure when you were kind of starting off, you know, you came from, you know, a design background, you know, and you kind of subsequently gone into managerial and leadership roles. The product manager role, I've worked with several, you know, amazing product managers, and the interesting thing is that they all tend to come from like completely different backgrounds. And I found that really interesting, because I think it really brings a freshness to the role. And I hope that kind of continues. I suppose maybe inevitably there'll be a more consistent linear way that people kind of get into it. But, you know, there are a lot of different ways. You know, you came from the design background, and, you know, I don't know what your kind of thoughts are on that kind of involvement, to actually having the know-how on the design stuff. Do you think that should be kind of a requirement to get into something like product design and product development, to have the actual know-how and the skill set? Or do you think that you can still be, you know, a really effective product manager without actually having the kind of technical ability?
I think it's a really good question. My background was coming up through design. I'm still heavily involved in design. So, you know, as the director of product design, I still have a heavy input into, you know, the customer facing view of what's happening. So I guess I've never lost that direct connection with design. But I work with a lot of product managers that come from, as you say, a wide variety of backgrounds. There's people from marketing, there's people from journalism backgrounds, psychology backgrounds, finance, business backgrounds. And I think, as we were discussing before, that's actually great, because it generates, there's lots of different cultures, lots of different ideas that are put into the mix, and everybody has that slightly different take. I think if somebody had come from, if we ended up with an organization of people that all come from the same, you know, they've been through the same process, they've been to product design school, and then they, you know, come out with a product design degree and then gone into sort of product management that way, we may find that, you know, everybody ends up skewed into one way of thinking, and that can be dangerous. Now, whether everyone needs the technical skills, I actually don't think they necessarily do, Because when I think about what I do day to day, I have the technical skills when it comes to the design, so I can go in and do that if I wanted to. But the people I'm working with are designers, they're researchers, they're developers. There's this front and back end development. I'm speaking on a day-to-day basis with people from marketing, from finance, from the commercial side. And these are all areas that I know very little about. You know, I know enough to be able to have sensible conversations with these people and understand what he's doing. But I, you know, I couldn't go in and do, certainly couldn't go in and do any, you know, high-end back-end engineering or anything like that. You know, that is certainly not where my skill set is. I think the product role just has a good understanding of what all those, what's involved in all those different skill sets, what's involved in all those different processes. But I think they don't necessarily have to have those skills themselves. I think that said, you know, if you come from an engineering background and you move into a product role, you'll probably find yourself working on in a product role that's quite heavily skewed towards engineering just because you are good at that. I mean, I think that can happen. But I've worked with some great product managers before who have come from, you know, journalism backgrounds, particularly the BBC. You know, they come from journalism backgrounds, great journalists. Moved over to products when, frankly, no one knew what product was. You know, become product managers and now, you know, working on some, you know, some of the world's, well, some of the country's biggest products, you know, from particularly the BBC, you know, the BBC News, BBC Sport, things like that, you know, multiple millions of people. And these are people that don't come from a, you know, a technical background. So I think that's kind of a long answer to say, I don't think it really matters if you have the skill sets, provided you can learn enough about the areas that you're working with to know what you need from those people.
I'd like to say, I do think it's positive. You know, I've had a lot of data people on the podcast.
Yeah.
And data is interesting because you kind of get a bit of a melting pot there as well. And they kind of say the same thing, that they do think it's, you know, it's a positive thing that there isn't this kind of linear way to get involved in the space. And I do genuinely think that that's good for, you know, for reasons, you know, cultural reasons, you know, for a lot of different reasons. But it's very interesting. And like you say, I think the concluding answer that you gave is that it doesn't really matter. I tend to agree with that. You know, do you still keep, obviously you're from the north, do you still keep tracks on, like how the kind of tech up north is the, and things are going on up north? Do you try and keep an eye on that, or are you fully?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
No, I may have been down south for quite a few years, but I'm still a northerner at heart, so I still keep an eye on the tech scene around Manchester, around Leeds. So I think I moved down to London about 15 years ago. I did do a stint for about 3 years back up in Manchester a few years back, and it was great to be back up north again. But I think the North Africa is very vibrant. It's great to see actually the tech scene kind of exploding, particularly around, you know, Manchester and Leeds. You know, I know a lot of people doing some very interesting stuff up there, and I can only see that getting better. I think there's still a huge challenge that there's so many roles down south in London that a lot of people do get pulled down here. And I would love to see more done to help with investment around tech and design and product in the north, just to, well, give people that grow up there basically the opportunity to stay up there and then potentially tempt some people from down south back up north again. Because there's bags of opportunity there, and, you know, house prices are a lot cheaper. So it's there's definitely benefits to it.
Yeah, that goes without saying. I think, yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think it certainly built traction. You know, me and myself have been out in California. I've also lived in London, so I've been to like two kind of huge tech hubs. And obviously moving back up north, it's like, it is different. You know, there's obviously not quite the scale and the scope that there is, you know, in London, for example. But I do think that things are moving in the right direction. And, you know, as soon as you start seeing the VC shops popping up and investors floating about, you typically know that there's some traction happening, which I think is only going to be like a massively positive thing. And I hope, like I say, it's so unnecessary for the size of our country. It's so unnecessary for everything to be in one area. It's just so unnecessary. You know, for everything to be in London, the size of our country, you can get from Manchester to London in like an hour and a half or whatever it is, an hour and 50 minutes. Like it's ridiculous that, like, for something that's that far away, it completely, you know, absorbs, you know, the economy. So hopefully, you know, with leveraging technology and innovation, maybe even in travel, for example, it'll help, you know, the North to really kind of you know, stand out.
I totally agree. I think, you know, the technology's there, that's already in place. I think travel is there, it's just people aware of it. You know, actually, it's like Manchester literally is an hour and a half away, 2 hours. If, you know, you want to nip for a meeting, you can do, either way. And I mean, when I was growing up, I grew up in Blackpool. So, you know, I really, as I started to, you know, become a designer and went to understand interaction design, I kind of saw London as the only real option for me, because I just didn't see any other major areas that had that kind of hub. I mean, in some respects, that was a bit naive. I think if I'd actually looked a bit harder, I would definitely have seen them. But then when I went back to Manchester in 2011, I think when I moved up with the BBC, we moved into Salford Quays up there, and it was really quiet. We were one of the first waves up there. But then in the course of about a year, year and a half, the entire vibe of the place changed. And I went back, I don't know, about 6 months ago, and it was just a different place. You know, it was a hive of activity. There was people everywhere. There was a couple of major broadcasters there now. There's a lot of small studios kicking up. There was a few development houses nearby. There was a vibe about it. And it felt like, you know, they're building something really interesting here. You know, there is now a hub of people. And, you know, give it a few more years, there's more little startups kick off in this area. People are joining the big organizations, but then leaving after a few years to do their own things. You know, there's some quite exciting opportunity there. And, you know, I just kind of hope that the area capitalizes on that and makes something of it and kind of keeps those people in that area and, you know, it tempts more people in there. Because I think, I certainly felt it when I was in Salford, it kind of felt like it was a bit of an outsider. And I mean that in a good way. Because it wasn't London as such, and because the expectation necessarily wasn't there, it meant that we could just do some awesome stuff without being bothered by lots of people. And then, you know, we were driving some great products out there. You know, we shipped the BBC's coverage of the Olympics, all the products, all the sort of websites and products and apps and things that drove that were shipped from there. Then we, you know, we relaunched the BBC Sport website, and we launched a number of big apps out there. And we were pretty much just left to it because we were, we essentially had that autonomy I talked about beforehand, where, you know, it was a small team, went up there, it was very creative, it didn't have the constraints that were kind of put onto the rest of the teams down in London. So it was a really exciting place to be, and you kind of get that vibe walking around the whole area that it's kind of seemed like that. So, you know, hopefully that will turn into something really interesting.
Yeah, and like you say, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about that kind of sense of autonomy and creating that. You know, if you kind of, like, say you throw a creative team up north, you're going to get some incredible things happen because they probably had that sense of autonomy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that can spur on some real excellence. Do you think that, you know, that there's more pressure in the bigger organisations to kind of not fall out of line and, you know, not having the ability to kind of fail? You know, like in smaller organisations, it's almost like, you know, if you're not failing, you're not innovating, and, you know, it's kind of understood that that's collateral, that we're going to fail fast, but we're going to get some incredibly innovative things out there. I can't speak from experience, so I guess that's why I'm asking the question, but do you think that there's, like, that kind of added pressure, and there isn't that kind of acceptance of, you know, that kind of fail fast, lean mentality in those organizations? And, you know, do you think that that can potentially be a hindrance? And, you know, well, that's why, obviously, you know, encouraging moves out to the north or whatever, you know, to create, you know, a bit of a creative hub is probably necessary.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair to say. Although every organisation I've ever worked in has always run seminars on, you know, how to fail fast and learn from it, you know, how to work lean. But actually, when you look at what's motivating people in all the different teams, well, and what KPIs are they actually being assessed against, it's very rare is there a KPI that has any kind of allowance for failure in there. So if you're working on a project and, you know, you're looking at, I don't know, driving conversion up by a couple of percent, then if you go back and deliver a project that pushes conversion down by a couple of cent, it's very rare in my view that the business sees that as a, oh, well, that was a great learning opportunity, let's move on from it. You know, there's a fallout from there. And although that is a learning opportunity and, you know, the proper product process tells you that you should learn from that, you then keep improving and then you drive that KPI up. In reality, people are scared naturally. You don't want to be the person. You don't want to be the person on the team that actually does drive that KPI down there. And I think that's really it is purely a problem with how leadership teams motivate everybody across an organization. You know, what are you being judged against? What's in your goals that year? And it's very rarely you can run three projects and fail at them all. And we got to think about creative ways of getting allowing for that kind of freedom in kind of the goal structure, in the KPI structure that lets people get that autonomy. Smaller organizations on the flip side don't necessarily have that. So DAZN, where I currently am, you know, we started 2.5-3 years ago, and I joined relatively early on, and you know, we had a set ambition to launch a product, and you know, we obviously had very aggressive KPIs and things like that, but there was also an inherent understanding that we were working incredibly fast and we would learn quickly, and not everything would necessarily be right straight away, but we would fix it as soon as we found the issues. And I think we kind of lived by that, and I think we still do. And you see it in the way that even the smallest of issues is never seen internally as somebody has failed. It's seen as, okay, then how do we fix that? And it's very interesting how it's reframed in terms of never. It's never about blame. It's never about working out who did something wrong. It's about just working out, well, how do we fix that and move on? Now, what will be interesting is, do we maintain that? You know, do we maintain that as we get bigger, as we become a bigger organization? You know, I think everybody internally certainly hopes so. But it's fascinating to see how a small organization just couldn't have that as part of their DNA, and larger organizations do really struggle with it. Because it really just is a small mentality change, but obviously small mentality changes are difficult across 20,000 people if you're in a mega organization.
Yeah, mate, it's hard enough to change one or two people,
isn't it? Tell me about it, yeah. Trying to talk people into, you know, sometimes getting people to agree where to go for lunch is difficult enough, so getting an entire organization to change the way it motivates people can be kind of tricky.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, or lunch is a good one. Also, these days it tends to be Netflix, like what to watch on Netflix with your partner, is typically one of those that's rather difficult these days.
Well, I now have a young son, so that argument's settled by Peppa Pig almost every time. So
yeah, you don't get to engage with the content you like anymore. Interesting. All this access, and you're stuck with Peppa Pig.
Exactly. Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree. You're not a bad thing. Mate, we're nearly at half an hour, so I don't want to keep you too much longer. But just to kind of address this one as well, the transition into kind of a management, into a kind of director leadership role, you know, a lot, we've had technical people from all different kinds of background. It's still a constant one that people say, you know, it's very challenging. It's almost like a new role in itself.
Yeah.
You know, ask the question in a different way, because I think it's a given that it is that. So, you know, if you were to go back and you know, look at that kind of period in time where you would have kind of moved into that more managerial leadership role, you know, how would you approach it now, you know, with the experience that you've gained to this point?
Well, when I look back and I made that transition, I don't think I realized I was making that transition. I think that's the first thing, is I was stepping up the ladder. I was moving from essentially a mid-weight position to a senior position. That senior position came with, you know, wider control of a project. It had a certain project management aspect to it. It had more control, but it also had a bit of line management involved as well. At least that's how I saw it at the time. I guess what I didn't realize, and what I would have a very strong talking to myself in the past would be, is really understand what you're doing. You are changing your role entirely. In fact, this is conversations I have with people in my teams nowadays, is when you're thinking about moving into more senior leadership positions, or even junior leadership positions, remember that you're changing from essentially delivering design and solving problems to dealing with people, and talking to people on a day-to-day basis, and helping people with their careers, and helping them solve issues, and, you know, potentially performance issues. And so have a serious think about what you actually want to be doing day in, day out. You know, are you the kind of person that is really excited about it? Which I must admit terrifies most people when I tell them, when they suddenly get this realization that that's what the role actually is. And I think I would have been pretty terrified as well when I made that transition, because I wanted to move up into leadership roles to have, you know, that, as we talked about many times, this autonomy over projects. And I didn't actually realize at the time, I think, that actually that what that really means is that you're really helping the team of people have autonomy over themselves. And in many respects, as a leader, you get less autonomy, because you're really at the mercy of your team, and you're there solely to make sure that team have got good stuff to do and are doing the best work they can do. It's a total flip in the way that you operate.
So I talk through with all my sort of midweight and seniors in my team. I always have long conversations about these types of things when they are looking to move up, because I kind of wish it's the kind of thing that I knew before I went into it. I think I would have been slightly more prepared. I don't think anybody truly knows what they're doing in these type of roles, but I certainly haven't got a clue when I first moved up.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's it, isn't it? It's a process. And, you know, I think the thing I encourage people is obviously just always be seeking out, I think, external approval as well, or you know, try and build relationships externally with peers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think that's helpful as well. It just gives you a sense of, you know, I think sometimes if you come up in the bubble, you want to find your own style as well. And I think everyone's kind of motivated to kind of add something different or something, you know, that's kind of theirs, their blueprint. And I think, you know, it's difficult to achieve that if you're going off your experiences internally. So I always kind of explain to people, you know, make the effort to connect with, you know, peers externally who've been in similar situations and get that advice. I think it's really invaluable advice that I've certainly always tried to take on board.
Yeah, I think it's essential. You know, speak to other people that are in basically the same situation and you'll find that they're having exactly the same types of challenges themselves. Get them to talk through how they're dealing with it. And every time I do that, it opens my eyes because I go, oh, actually, you know, this is everybody in these positions have exactly the same types of issues. You know, they're all thinking about their team, how to get their team to be able to do great stuff. They might have someone in the team who's going through a bad time, how to help them. You know, they've all gone through the same things. And I guess the other flip thing I'd tell myself sort of when I was going through that transition period is, don't get over reliance on like management courses and management books, because there's a billion of them out there. And to your point before, you kind of have to find your own style. And as much as it's great to hear somebody else's theory who's done it before, it's really just about bouncing ideas off other people and finding your own way through it, because all the advice you will get is off people who've got their own style, and their style might not necessarily work for you.
Agreed, mate. Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. We'll leave it there. It's been really good talking to you, mate. I can't believe it's already been half an hour. But, you know, lunch is calling, of course.
It is indeed. It is indeed.
Thank you so much, mate. I really enjoyed the chat. Appreciate it.
Likewise.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.